The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. In the month made for snow days, it was a bomb day out in L.A., where bombs are more associated with failed Hollywood monster movies than school closings. At last night's Republican presidential debate in Las Vegas, Ted Cruz grabbed that storyline and reminded the audience how a former Hollywood actor once saved the world.
You know, my daughters, Caroline and Catherine, came tonight. They're 7 and 5, and you think about the Los Angeles schools canceling their schools today. And every parent is wondering, how do we keep our kids safe? We need a commander-in-chief who does what Ronald Reagan did with communism, which is he set out a global strategy to defeat Soviet communism, and he directed all of his... So I'm answering the question, Dana. He directed all of his forces to defeating communism.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz in Las Vegas at the debate last night will have more hyperbole from the GOP screenwriter candidates later this hour. It was the best of times, though. It was the worst of times. It was a credible threat. It was a complete hoax. The threat that closed the L.A. schools yesterday was sent to New York City officials in a tale of two cities that raises questions about vigilance in the era of ISIS. Here's Ramon Cortinas, the superintendent of L.A. schools.
I can't take a chance, and all schools, I've asked them to be searched today.
But New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton suggested that was an overreaction.
Based on the information I'm working with, if that's the same information they had, I think, yes, that it's what they want, whether it's a prankster or a terrorist.
Is the can't-take-a-chance attitude too sensitive a trigger in this era? Does there need to be better standardization of threat evaluation in U.S. communities? Marisa Rendazzo is managing partner of Sigma Threat Management and a former chief research psychologist for the Secret Service. She joins us from WETA, public radio station in Arlington, Virginia. Marisa, welcome.
Thanks.
So what do you think of this really divergent reaction to this threat that L.A. had and that New York had? And again, we don't know if they're exact, but what do you think?
Threat assessment is really a fact-finding process where you do the best you can with the information you have available. You see what you've got. And for these two districts, they saw information coming in by email that indicated a specific intent to do harm at schools in their districts. Now, what happens once you get that initial report is you seek out other information. So in both cases, they likely went to local law enforcement for L.A. They had L.A. County sheriffs involved and other folks, as well as going to federal law enforcement. So they would likely reach out to the FBI in a case like this, probably involve their Joint Terrorism Task Force to see what else do they know. When you reach out to federal law enforcement, you often get that connection. So you'd hear, well, we've gotten something very similar in across the nation on the East Coast, looking at what LA had on the West Coast. But threat assessment takes some time to pull information together to see, is this a credible threat or not? And I think what we saw is these two districts, with what limited information they had, made different decisions in terms of what precautionary steps they wanted to take.
Well, but that's a little alarming. I mean, is it really a coin flip? I mean, you have the same information,
No, and
one person says we close the schools, another person says it's an overreaction.
It really isn't a coin flip. They really have to make the most prudent decision they can make, given the information they have available, as they're still trying to gather more information.
But how can both be right? How can both be right in that situation?
Well, let's look at what happened in the L.A. area. So in San Bernardino, we saw a shooting that occurred with mass casualties that has really rocked that whole area. And L.A. is very close by to San Bernardino. For them, they had a different context. For them, they said, look, this is a cost for us we're willing to take. We were willing to make this decision to say, let's have students stay home from school today so that we can do these full searches. Because for us, we've seen something right next door occur with horrific consequences. For New York, for what they were seeing, they thought, no, we're not. We don't think there's any credibility to this, so we're going to take a different stance. It really has to do in large part with the context of what you're seeing. L.A. and San Bernardino just saw something horrific. So for them, they wanted to take an extra precautionary step.
But couldn't you make an argument that that context would actually be a justification for not doing something in L.A.? Because you basically take the context, which is different from the threat. There was no indication that they were related, at least from this threat. And maybe that would have been an argument to be more, you know, stand firm here and not cancel schools, because when you have that echo of San Bernardino in the community, you run the risk of amplifying a sense of unease. Now people go back to school today even more nervous than they were yesterday, and you've raised a level of unease in the entire community. And I wonder if that's an appropriate role for the superintendent of schools.
I actually don't think they raised a level of unease. I think, in fact, what they did was they took that time. By canceling school, they took that time to be able to do thorough sweeps of all of their schools, which takes an extensive amount of time to do. So they were able to provide a measure, an objective measure of safety. We looked into it, whether the threat was credible or not. We've now swept all of our schools to determine there were no such items that were mentioned in this email. So they were able to verify that the threat was not credible. New York made a decision, we don't believe there's credibility to this, therefore we're not going to. LA said, that may be the case. We want to take an extra step to make sure all of our students and all of our personnel are safe. And I think what we need to remember is that there was no such threat prior to the San Bernardino shootings. So the fact that they had one, they felt an obligation to the safety of their students and the safety of their employees to make sure they were taking that extra step to ensure safety.
Finally, does this event suggest some sort of more standard federal approach to these kinds of threats, a quicker response time to these kinds of threats when you're dealing with the scale of students, 640,000 in L.A., it's even more in New York?
One of the things that I do want to highlight is that threat assessment is considered to be best practice for preventing a whole host of school-related violence, whether it's coming from an individual who may be despondent or disgruntled, or whether it's coming from someone who may have a terrorist agenda or may have been influenced by some sort of violent extremism. We're looking at gathering information to see if someone is actually planning to do something violent, whatever the motive or impetus may be. It really is considered to be best practice, and I want to highlight the fact that LA Unified School District has actually had a very well-respected threat assessment program in place for a number of years. So I don't know specifically if they were involved in this, but it is that really considered to be the gold standard for preventing harm in schools.
Marisa Randazzo, thanks so much for coming in to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Marisa Randazzo is managing partner of Sigma Threat Management and a former chief research psychologist for the Secret Service. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill got a deal last night with no government shutdown. Mr. Smooth Speaker of the House Paul Ryan and the leaders in the Senate finished a $1.1 trillion deal. Now they can go home for the holidays. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. They can go home for the holidays. Is the government safe until next year?
We're not quite there yet. This deal is important, and it goes a long way to avoiding a government shutdown and extending, oh gosh, about $600 million in tax provisions that were going to expire. But this thing still has to pass. And John, early today, Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader, has been making some loud noises on Capitol Hill that she's not thrilled with the deal. It'll probably pass, and that'll avoid a government shutdown. A shutdown isn't really in the offing here anyway, but this deal is bipartisan. It was put together, and there are a lot of big trade-offs, things that got in and didn't get in. One big win for the Republicans here, John, a huge one that they've been gunning for decades, the oil export ban on American petroleum repealed. American oil is going to go onto the global market after this deal, and Democrats don't like that at all. In exchange, and this thing is all about trade-offs and horse trading, in exchange, Democrats got a 5-year extension of federal tax breaks for wind and solar. Those were going to expire. Republicans only wanted to give them 1 year or two. They got 5 years in exchange for repealing the oil export ban. That was a big one. Now, here's something that's in. Visa waiver restrictions, which we've been talking about a lot since San Bernardino, tightening up regulations on visa waivers from 38 countries, people from Europe and other friendly countries who come into this country. Those new restrictions are in the agreement. What's out? That ban on Syrian refugees that got so much attention. That's not in, and conservatives in the House are not happy. There's another big trade-off involved. John, a couple of other...
Let's just clarify one thing on the visas. We've been talking about visas since San Bernardino, but the issue in San Bernardino is the K-1 spousal visa. The issue in Paris is more the visa waivers that would involve Europeans and other countries coming in without having to have a visa, right?
Right, that's right. And K-1 restrictions are not in this deal. Lawmakers say that's on tap to be dealt with in the new year and that they do want to deal with that. And with a whole host, there's a long list of other, some of them are arcane visa and security issues, sort of a laundry list that they want to deal with in the new year that people are now talking about and learning about since those two attacks. So K-1 not in, visa waivers is in, and the controversial Syrian refugee policy is not. Now, that the fact that the Syrian refugee policy is not in there is important because that is helping to drive away quite a lot of conservatives for this deal, and they're going to need, like with all big spending deals in Congress, John, Democrats to vote for it. And there's a couple of other things that Democrats are going to like in here, a bunch of attempts from Republicans on riders that are not in this deal. There are no new rollbacks of Dodd-Frank, the Wall Street restrictions. There were some attempts to have abortion riders and family planning riders. Those are all out as well. Now, here's one thing that Democrats don't like, John. Listen to Harry Reid. Democrats really, really wanted to give some special powers to Puerto Rico to deal with its financial crisis through bankruptcy. Here's Harry Reid.
Easiest thing to do would be to treat a territory so that they can file bankruptcy. And this is what I've been advocating for. There are other more complicated ways of doing this. But I would hope that before it's all through here, that they can just file bankruptcy. That has not been agreed to by the Republicans yet.
Is that likely to happen?
No, it's not in this deal. Puerto Rico gets no special help and they can't use bankruptcy. So that debate is going to rage on. And a lot of lobbyists and representatives from Puerto Rico, in addition to Democrats, were desperate to get that in there. They didn't want it. John, one other important thing, the health fund for 9/11 first responders. Been in the news a lot lately.
The John Stewart thing. Yeah,
absolutely. This is in the deal. $8.1 billion for the health fund and the compensation fund. John Stewart and the 9/11 responders. They win on this one. Obamacare loses a little bit. There are two tax provisions that Republicans and some Democrats have been gunning for years. There's a thing called a Cadillac tax. Expensive health insurance plans that unions love had a new tax to help pay for Obamacare. That tax has been delayed and the unions are thrilled. And medical device manufacturers, John, they're thrilled too because there's a medical device tax that started in Obamacare in 2013. That's been delayed as well. So they get a break for another 2 years.
So the only thing we have to worry about is a PLN, Pelosi loud noises on the government shutdown?
Well, they can make a big difference. I know the last time she made loud noises like this, the bill wound up passing in the Cromnibus in 2014. But Paul Ryan is going to need her votes because he has a lot of Republicans who don't like this deal. So it's going to be the next 48 hours of whipping and counting votes to see if it passes.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the GOP debate last night, community colleges in Walla Walla, Washington, and the history of Jamaica's Cold War violence.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
The GOP debate was a coming out party last night for Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
Baby, let's cruise away from here.
One of the most troubling aspects of the Rubio Schumer Gang of Eight bill was that it gave President Obama blanket authority to admit refugees, including Syrian refugees. We should direct at the problem, focus on the problem, and defeat radical Islamic terrorism. It's not a war on a faith. It's a war on a political and theocratic ideology that seeks to murder us. And we were told then that there were these moderate rebels that would take over. Well, the result is Libya is now a terrorist war zone run by jihadists.
Who would have imagined that this fellow right here...
Do you like green eggs and ham?
Yes. Who would have expected that that fellow so eloquently filibustering in the Senate would now be chasing Donald Trump to be front runner in the Republican presidential campaign? Last night's debate showed Cruz prepared and aggressive on stage at the Venetian Resort Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas.
You know, Marco said he learned that the American people didn't
Senator
trust
Cruz,
the federal government.
No, Dana,
he
you
campaigned
need to ask
in Florida
Ted,
promising to lead the fight against
Ted Cruz
amnesty.
Support legalizing
he campaigned promising
illegally.
To lead the fight against
Ladies
amnesty.
Ladies and gentlemen,
and
this
exactly
is why
that.
The American
Dana,
people
Dana,
are Senator Cruz, can you answer
point.
That question, please?
Does Ted Cruz rule out ever legalizing people that are in this country illegally now?
Senator Cruz?
I have never supported legalization.
Do you rule it out?
I have never supported legalization, and I do not intend to support legalization.
Wow, some hot stuff there. Joining us now, Peggy Venable is a senior policy fellow at the conservative organization Americans for Prosperity Foundation in Austin, Texas. She joins us from KUT, Austin, Texas. Welcome, Peggy. And I understand you're speaking as a Cruz supporter, not as a member of Americans for Prosperity.
Absolutely. I'm speaking on behalf of myself only, not on behalf of the organization.
All right. So you're a Cruz supporter, all right?
I am.
All right. So we're gonna give as good as the senator gives here, all right? I hope you don't mind. How do you think he did last night, by the way?
I think Senator Cruz did a great job last night. He consistently does. He's probably the brightest guy on the stage, and there are a lot of bright people on the stage. I thought everyone did well. But I think Cruz really performed last night, again, as he usually does. He's always prepared and aggressive, articulate. He knows where he stands on issues, and he doesn't waver.
What's changed in this debate, and how do you think the whole campaign itself is going, based on your experience?
I think he's right where he wants to be. Nobody wants to be the front runner out early. I think he is slow and steady. He's got a great ground game. He understands the grassroots. He has boots on the ground in these states, and I think that's going to pay off.
Peggy, what do you make of this tone of this campaign so far? Listen.
You're never going to be president of the United States by insulting your way to the presidency.
Well, let's see. I'm at 42 and you're at 3, so far I'm doing better.
Doesn't matter.
So far I'm doing better. You know, you started off over here, Jeb. You're moving over further and further. Pretty soon you're going to be off the end.
This doesn't do a thing to solve the problem. It doesn't do a thing to solve
it. Go ahead.
Peggy Venable, does Ted Cruz rise above that or does he jump into the mud?
You know, he doesn't jump into the mud. And I have to say, this is a campaign unlike any that I've seen. And I actually worked in the 76 campaign. I'm an old campaigner. And, you know, this is an interesting campaign. I don't think anyone's really ready to predict just what's going to happen. But Ted Cruz, I think, is failing to take the bait. If you just look at last week when Donald Trump lobbed one at him as a maniac and he came out with that music video, I think he is lighthearted. He takes things in stride. I think he's well prepared for this, and I think he's doing a great job.
All right, let's talk about some of the policy issues. I mean, he's very hard and fast against immigration. I mean, do you actually buy this build a wall idea from Ted Cruz and from Donald Trump, although he wants Donald Trump to pay for it?
We will build a wall that works, and I'll get Donald Trump to pay for it.
You know, I have to say that I'm not confident that a wall is the answer, but then I am not an immigration expert, and it's not my key issue. I do believe that Ted Cruz focuses on adherence to the rule of law, and I think that's really important, that he is going to adhere to the Constitution and to our laws.
Let's talk about the Muslim comments that Donald Trump made. You know, Ted Cruz didn't, you know, back away from those comments, but he did say that Muslims should be monitored. Do you go along with that?
Well, I have to say personally, I think that the country is concerned. People are afraid. They recognize full well that there is an element of radical Islamic terrorism that is really striking at Christmas parties and at concerts, I mean, at our very way of life. So I believe that it's appropriate to monitor individuals who, for some reason, have gotten the attention of the folks that are looking for who might cause trouble in this country. And I think it's clear that we've failed to do so on some occasions.
Are you worried about Marco Rubio?
You know, I have to say I like Marco Rubio. There's not a person on that stage that I actually don't like or don't agree with on some things.
Oh, come on, Rand Paul. You don't like Rand Paul. I can tell.
Actually, I have to say I was a fan of his dad's on some issues. When it comes to foreign policy, I'm not sure I want Rand Paul and to have the title president in front of him. But let's face it, there's just going to be one candidate come out of this, and I don't think people have actually started to focus yet. When they do, I think Ted Cruz will do well. He is on cruise control right now.
How do you stop Trump?
Well, I don't know if Trump will stop Trump or not. I think that's going to be kind of interesting. It is an anomaly. And again, I've watched presidential campaigns for years. I don't know that anyone can actually have predicted where we would be right now. But then again, 8 years ago, people would not have predicted that Obama would be the Democrat nominee. So I think that polls are not as consistent as they used to be. People are using their cell phones. The polling, I don't think, is as good as it could or should be. So I take little credence to the polls.
So your position right now at this point in the campaign is that it is Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, who's going to say you're fired to Donald Trump.
I'd love to hear Ted Cruz say that. You know, he's really mastered the issues, and he has the ability to articulate his positions very well. He has a strong ground game again. And right now, I put my money on Cruz.
She's an early Ted Cruz supporter and a Republican activist in Texas, Peggy Venable. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website builder that provides domains, hosting, and website templates, all with 24/7 customer support. More at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
East of booming tech metropolis Seattle, the rich agricultural lands of Washington State stretch across the Yakima Valley and beyond. But those lands have found prosperity hard to maintain. This week, the Takeaways Community College Challenge takes us to an institution trying to enrich the labor force of its community and be a gateway to a global education for its students. The 100-acre campus of Walla Walla Community College in Washington State is home to several acres of vineyards and a viticulture program that's integral to the area's wine industry. The school also educates prison inmates from two institutions in the area. Here are some voices from WWCC, including the man in charge, President Stephen Van Osdell.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Our vision was to provide education and training on how to grow the best wine grapes and make the best wine in the world. We have helped transform an economy by creating over 6,000 jobs and over $300,000 in earned income in a rural area, and made Walla Walla a destination.
So it's from Victoria. It's made in the typical Cote Rôti style, which is majority Shiraz with a hint of Viognier, specifically for its aromatics.
The Enology and Viticulture program, I believe, is very special. It's super hands-on. We were, you know, picking grapes, taking bird netting off, and getting fruit in and processing all this fruit before we even started the quarter.
Any takers for aromas or flavors? Menthol, eucalyptus? Is that the Australian thing going on?
The diversity of our class is unparalleled anywhere. I've never gone to school any place that has such an unusual cross-section in the student body.
Being a 52-year-old, it's interesting being in a program where the ages really range from 19 to early 60s. And what you find really quickly is that age difference dissipates and that we're all sort of in the same place. Some of us just have fewer wrinkles than others.
About 2 weeks before they graduate, we have a bottling truck come. We blend up, we finish all their wines, and we bottle the wine kind of as a celebration as to the last thing they do here.
Here we are coming up to our next Sallyport system. Visiting rooms on your left. Close custody units are on your right.
We're experiencing extraordinary success right now with inmates that have gone through workforce programs. We now educate about 1,600 inmates each year at two of the largest facilities in the state that represents nearly 40% of the prison population in Washington State.
The goal is to teach them a trade that there's lots of opportunity in,
and then that not everybody has. So it makes them marketable so that they can get out there and succeed with a living wage job. Hopefully the program gives them skills and the confidence to just be a different person.
One student in here was 22 years old. He painted a car and took it outside, and everybody from the surrounding shops came and looked at it as a bright red sports car. And he just almost broke down in tears because that's the first time in his life he's ever had anybody compliment him on anything, any feeling of accomplishment.
And what did we say capacitance was? Storage. That's correct. And what's the symbol for it? Farads.
A lot of these guys are 30 years old and has never had a job, believe it or not. Some of them aren't done being in trouble yet. I've had students here that have gone out and got back in trouble and been killed since they've been in here, you know, been shot.
I mean, you can't put a price on these guys' education because you'll never know how much it impacted them and their family and their kids that aren't even born yet, you know. Just having that impact, and by just doing my job, I'm able to benefit from their benefit in more ways than one.
I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
The Takeaways Community College Challenge has introduced us to students all across the country, from the streets of Harlem to the Texas border city of El Paso, from South Dakota's High Plains and the Big Sioux River to the theme park destinations of Orlando, Florida. We'll be following all of them through 2016. Washington State's Walla Walla Community College ties itself to the region through its winemaking program and its work with prison inmates, among other programs. But Dr. Stephen Van Alsdell measures success one face at a time.
One particular student I remember, Ruben Garcia, came here and completed his high school degree equivalency, a GED. First-generation student, became our student body president. We have a program with Whitman College that provides an opportunity for a minority student to take some courses free of charge there to see if they can handle the academic rigor. And Ruben did, and he completed his bachelor's degree at Whitman College. So when you see individuals that get inspired and motivated, it's very gratifying.
That's Walla Walla College President Dr. Stephen Van Alsdell. When he took the job in 1984, the college, the faculty, and the community were headed for some rough times. The city of 37,000 was hit hard in the 1990s. Like other American cities, cheap imports led to big job losses. Since introducing its wine school 15 years ago, wineries in the valley have increased from a few dozen to nearly 200. Want to be an enologist? Go to Walla Walla.
One of the program areas that has emerged that's helped transform our community has been an enology and viticulture program. And we had a fledgling industry with about 15 winemakers at the time the college decided to take this on as we were kind of reinventing what we were doing to help a struggling economy. So we started an enology program, and it has met with great success. Now, we haven't done it alone. It's been partnerships.
Can a community college actually make, for instance, the winemaking businesses in your region better and more prosperous?
Well, I think, the nature of our economy in this country today and certainly in rural areas as well is dependent upon talent. Talent appears to be the primary driver of change and prosperity. What we contributed was a large number of pretty highly educated people to an industry that needed that quality of labor and labor supply. So when you think that we're adding over 30 individuals a year into this rural economy that has this level of expertise, makes a huge difference.
Walla Walla tries to make a huge difference for inmates who enroll in its prison education program that's been producing benefits for the community for decades.
We have a long history back to into almost the beginning of Walla Walla Community College in 1968 of educating inmates. Initially, it was on our campus, and then we committed to build a strong program at the Washington State Penitentiary. And one unique program we have is an academic transfer program funded by the Sunshine Lady Foundation. That's Doris Buffett. And we have evidence that the inmates are extraordinarily successful as they move from prison onto colleges and universities and pursue career paths. The recidivism rate at our Coyote Ridge Correctional Center of those students has, in the last 4 years, is zero. And at the Washington State Penitentiary, which is a higher risk population, The success rate is very high. And again, the recidivism rate, I think, out of 258 inmates that have completed degrees at those two institutions, only 8 have returned to prison.
But if you were a student today and Walla Walla was the only option for you, what would attract you to it as a student, not as an administrator?
Well, I think students find an environment here in which they can thrive, and our students are here by choice. Many cases, some of them do have other options. What I would find as a student here is a clear pathway to a clear result. As a student, I would look at the completion rates at Walla Walla Community College and see them as one of the top in the nation and have pretty good confidence that I'm going to be able to complete my program of studies and move into the labor markets or go on to a four-year college or university.
Dr. Van Osdell is president of Walla Walla Community College. There's much more at thetakeaway.org/community college. We have an interactive community college map. Find out where yours is and how it's performing. We have images, audio, and links to help you find out a lot more.
Charlie Hebdo, a satirical magazine, has been attacked before.
We're actually beginning to establish a relationship with Cuba that I think can be helpful in a number of areas.
In all the countries of the world, they're looking at the Syrian people like they are terrorists, or they're like bad people. All we want to do is just find a new place that we can learn the language and be a productive citizen and start to work.
In Nepal, it is not just the Kathmandu Valley that has been affected and impacted by the major earthquake.
Our daughter now has her parents married, and every single state across this country is a big deal. It's an emotional day.
The problem with the Volkswagen diesel emissions scandal is there's no way to fix it.
ISIS is showing off the bomb it says brought down that Russian passenger jet.
One of the amazing things about Pluto, it seems to have seasons.
We have reached an agreement on the Iranian nuclear issue.
The hospital was repeatedly hit, both the front and the rear, and extensively destroyed and damaged.
It had been 40 minutes since the concert began. I saw guys with Kalashnikovs aimed at us.
Nobody just gets upset at a party, goes home and puts together that kind of an elaborate plan to come back and do that. So there was some planning that went into this.
Each year on The Takeaway, we try to talk to people who might be reflecting on a great year and are full of hope about the next one. Marlon James had a great year in 2015, heck of a lot better than the 78 rejections for his first novel he got before he found a publisher back in 2005. Marlon landed the Man Booker Prize this year for his third novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings, about the violent politics of Jamaica back in the 1970s.
I set out to just write a novel about one singular event and how it affects a few people. That it blew up into this thing about where it becomes a novel about the Cold War and the CIA is as much a shock to me as to the person reading it.
Marlon James says he learned to go with the flow in his third novel, and he won the Booker. Not bad. His next project, he describes it as a quote-unquote African Game of Thrones from the 11th century. More from author Marlon James next on The Takeaway. The 1970s saw the rise of reggae and ska music, a soundtrack to the Cold War politics that turned Jamaica into a battle between socialism and reactionary military leaders. Almost exactly 39 years ago, as socialist Prime Minister Michael Manley was struggling to keep order, Bob Marley himself became the target of violence.
Entertainer and reggae star Bob Marley, Rita Marley, and the manager of the Wailers, Don Taylor, are now patients in the University Hospital after receiving gunshot wounds during a shooting incident tonight.
Political violence has become a very emotive issue in this election campaign. There have been charges and countercharges, but a far more serious political question is posed by those who insist that incidents like the shooting of Bob Marley is part of a plot to destabilize Jamaica and halt the progress of what they see as democratic socialism.
This history comes to life in one of this year's biggest novels, A Brief History of Seven Killings. It's a violent story that the author Marlon James grew up with, and which was enough to win James this year's Man Booker Prize. It's the first for a Jamaican writer in the 47-year history of the prize. James, in reflecting on a pretty darn good year for 2015, says that for him, the echoes of those bullets that nearly killed Bob Marley 39 years ago are still too fresh to be regarded for him as history.
This is not a historical novel. This is a present tense event, and it's still unfolding, and we're still reeling from it. And we still find it very painful to talk about, so most of us don't. And that was the main thing, that I was writing a novel that in Jamaica we tend to leave for bedroom discussions or discussions on the veranda, nothing that takes place on a public stage, even though we've all talked about these things.
In this book, there are just no good guys at all here. It really feels like it just everyone is compromised in such a bad way.
Which is politics, I think. Especially in the Jamaican situation, the closest we come to a good guy is the ghost at the beginning of the book, and he was murdered. It's funny. When he died, the characters who form a composite for that guy, a lot of people think the hope of Jamaica died with him. The hope of Jamaica died with these sort of really idealistic young men of the 50s. And what was left is a battlefield, first for the Cold War, but also for a really, really cynical blend of politics that realize that there's no difference between ballots and bullets. One creates the other. And that led to a really, really terrible time that we were reeling from all the way into the 90s. I think one of the reasons why our elections have stopped being violent is that there's just nobody left to fire the guns.
Do you feel that what happened in Jamaica and Cuba, in a certain sense, I mean, you evoke this kind of island culture and its connection to the United States and the crack epidemic that took place in that period of time? I think most Americans have no idea about that history, what really happened. And coming from your perspective, it just feels like a much scarier time than it was in Chicago and New York.
It was. The fact is, to stop the spread of communism, U.S. foreign policy made some really terrible bedfellows. All they had to have in common is that they're against communism. What they were for was a totally different story. And bear in mind, this is a claim of a lot of these guys who went on to become drug lords, is that they learned to fire guns from the CIA or from the School of the Americas, that as long as you're on board to fight the scourge of communism, what you did in your own free time was your business. And that was a discovery for me, because I set out to just write a novel about one singular event and how it affects a few people. That it blew up into this thing about where it becomes a novel about the Cold War and the CIA is as much a shock to me as to the person reading it.
And at the center of this is, of course, Bob Marley and the attempt on his life. How did you first understand that event before this novel adorns it with all of this extraordinary history?
I understood it the way a six-year-old would understand it, that something really bad happened to somebody really famous. But the difference was, and I don't know if it's because my mother was a cop and my dad was a lawyer and they're both involved in justice, law enforcement. I don't know if that's why, but I think a kid can tell when their parents are scared. What I remember about Marley getting shot was not necessarily the event, but how it was the first time I think my parents were scared, which is saying something for a year like 1976. The idea that if Marley could be shot, anybody could be shot.
You describe violence in a way, well, that doesn't have a lot of analogs, at least in my experience reading. There's a scene in here, your ghost is talking about a character being dragged for a very long period of time. They've been pulling you for miles, and you twist and turn, but the last time you twisted, you rolled onto your belly, and the rocks felt worse, slicing lines down your belly, a jagged red one, cracking your right kneecap. They've been dragging you over secret roads, forgotten lanes, weed-ambushed paths, and hidden rivers. You're not heavy at all. Nobody under 20 is heavy. I try to bow my head in reverence as we march, but my head falls whenever I nod and my neck snaps. You've been screaming for miles, but the scream dies in a gag, but I will be there to listen. Did you have a sense that you were going to die if you didn't watch your step and no one would know?
For me, no, not really. For these guys, certainly. I was just really interested in how these men who tried to kill him sort of vanished. A lot of the cruelty that happens in Jamaica, that happens not just to these guys, but to people every day, is off-screen. I'm a big believer that violence should be violent. I'm a big believer that you actually should lose a little of yourself at the end of a scene like that. As long as it doesn't turn into a pornography, as long as you don't become numb to it, then I think we should be as visceral and as there as, you know, as, you know, as we can be. But it is disturbing. It's disturbing to just hear you read it back to me. I'm like, what trance was I in when I wrote that?
Does this image of Jamaica reconcile with the kind of island, vacation land, happy talk Jamaica that we see so often in pop culture?
I think the danger is thinking Jamaica is one or the other. The danger also of thinking that 1976 Jamaica or 1979 when that scene happens is 2015 Jamaica, and it's not. It's unrecognizable. I think it's important to take stock of both. I think there are a lot of Jamaicans who toe the line that everybody should be a tourism advertisement for Jamaica, and they actually can't stand my work because they think I'm degrading the country. But then there are others who believe that we've had this culture of silence. I think not coming to terms with the things that happened in our past, you know, has led to this sort of culture where we don't talk about anything at all.
How are you going to top this year? What's your goal for 2016?
2016, wow, other than working at the TV show, I'm working on my next book where I'm bidding goodbye to the 20th century for a little bit. I'm writing a book set in the 11th.
Oh, nice. A little bit about the, well, it's a pre-slave trade, right? 11th century?
Well, not necessarily pre. The slave trade was still pretty widespread and pretty terrible. It was just was an Eastern slave trade, but it was just as bad and there were just as many millions who were being sold. So I'm definitely going to look at that and some other aspects. But yeah, I'm going to the 11th century.
Marlon James, Man Booker Prize winning author of A Brief History of Seven Killings. Here's something to take with you today. What do we have lots of? Air. Clean, clear Rocky Mountain air. What does China need? Clean air. They had to issue a red alert for air quality last week. But some folks who didn't relish the feeling of smoking 40 cigarettes a day and had some cash got some fresh air courtesy of Vitality Air. The Canadian company bottles Rocky Mountain air from Banff and Lake Louise at a price 50 times the price of bottled water. Sold out in 4 days. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.